Hey everyone, it's Jalian. As the hosts of We Live Here, Lauren and I balance deep dives into systemic issues with inspiring stories about people working to make a difference in their own communities. So when a listener reached out and introduced us to the work of Jeffrey J.D. Dixon, an activist organizing cleanups and coalitions in East St. Louis, a predominantly Black city in Illinois, we knew that we'd have to drive across the river to share his story. It was a beautiful, sunny day when we met JD in the parking lot of a local elementary school on State Street, a major street that runs east to west across East St. Louis.
By tomorrow, the kids will be able to, instead of looking across the lot and see trash and debris and litter, they'll be able to see a clean field with no trash. And, you know, it'll be an uplifting look instead of seeing trash, you know, because that's like, you could say, you know, just like the aesthetic of looking at trash and debris, you know, it could bring you down. But when you see cleanness, it gives you more hope. And, you know, that's part of the environmental racism, too, is the despair of looking at, you know, run down houses, trash and everything. But when you see cleanness, you know, you have a better feeling about yourself.
The cleanup was one of several that JD and his grassroots group, Empire 13, have hosted along the major road as part of their Boots to the Streets campaign.
When we do come out and we are together, the energy is amazing. Like, you'll be able to feel it while you're out here. The community, the vibe is just, it's great. And then you leave with the feeling of knowing that you physically helped, and also we're pushing legislation at the same time. So it's not an effort or action that's going in vain at all.
Their efforts have paid off by unifying East St. Louisans who are passionate about cleaning up the city, from a local church group to a group called Regular Everyday Citizens, or REC. Thomas Brown, who founded a youth education nonprofit called Building the Foundation, is another local resident who joined the campaign.
I got a cleaning initiative, that's why we work out here with them. It's called Keep It Clean ESTL. So basically we just out here in the community, basically do the same thing that he do. We put boots to the ground and get out here and just start cleaning up our community. So we be focusing on cleaning up on the community, working with them, and we get out every last Saturday of the month.
The campaign has attracted people across Illinois, like Cindy McMullen and Chris Peters, who came from a chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, based in the predominantly white city of Columbia in southern Illinois.
It's interesting because we started as strangers, and we're now friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
yes, you know, because yeah. we're
and
following
the energy
the
he has in his organization has been awesome. And it was just, this is our third one coming out, and we just love coming out here and being part of the community and getting involved with this. So I'm so thankful he's doing this.
And it starts with one or two, but then it is a momentum. Well, we call it a momentum. Sorry, we've got to throw that
in
there.
And with that, it was time for the volunteers to get to work.
I think we got a good set of group now, so we could go ahead, we could all start right here and do a straight, form a line and go straight across. All the material and trash and everything's over here, gloves and everything, so we could all suit up and gear up and get ready. Now,
let's
say
that fence too, the fence
up?
By the...
yeah, I was looking at.
Yeah, let's try
you
to
You want to knock that down?
Yeah, let's,
yep, let's knock that down too. All right, that sounds good.
Through cleanups and protests, JD is building a broad coalition for racial and environmental justice in East St. Louis and beyond. So in this episode, we'll learn more about JD's demand for legislative reform, hear from a political science professor about the legacy of industrial suburbs, and talk to a reporter about how JD is one of many Black residents in the Metro East area of Illinois who are pushing back against environmental racism. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. From a young age, JD was aware of the environmental disparities in the Metro East area of Illinois, between predominantly black cities like East St. Louis and predominantly white cities like Belleville.
You see the disparities. You go from pothole-filled streets, run-down abandoned buildings, trash litter literally everywhere along the ground, fields and everywhere, to manicure lawns, upkept buildings, no potholes, street cleaning trucks and crews you see driving around everywhere making sure that the town is clean, and it's just a mile stretch away. So just the visual aspect was the first time I've seen it, and the first time I even noticed it was just as a kid. I didn't know what I was looking at or knew what it was, but I knew it was wrong. As I grew up and became more aware of everything, I realized that it was environmental racism, because there was no reason that the same cleaning crews and trucks that are in Belleville and Fairview Heights and O'Fallon can't come down to East St. Louis, Edgemont, and Washington Park, and we're all within the same county of St. Clair.
Even though he currently lives closer to Belleville, JD remains passionate about East St. Louis, the black city that raised his parents and cousins, which his grandmother still calls home. 3 years ago, he started the Phoenix Project, his first community cleanup in East St. Louis. But he explains that trash pickups and lawn care could only go so far when the legacy of redlining, structural racism, systemic disinvestment, and mass incarceration continue to devastate black neighborhoods.
We have to change the actual look of our environment. We have to take down the abandoned buildings and build up new buildings. We have to clear out these abandoned lots and put vibrant businesses and homes and even raised gardens, farmers markets, and to show that we are a community that can thrive, just like how Black Wall Street was in Oklahoma. East St. Louis can and will be the same thing.
In 1920, the Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Black Wall Street, was one of the most prosperous Black communities in the U.S. It was home to around 10,000 people, many of whom moved there to escape the Jim Crow South as part of the Great Migration. It's said that the dollar circulated among the residents of Greenwood anywhere from 30 to 100 times. Those dollars supported the growth of Black-owned businesses like grocery stores, banks, theaters, and hotels, and the development of schools, churches, and community centers that centered and celebrated Black culture and achievement. But all of that changed on May 31st and July 1st, 1921, when white residents of Tulsa, armed and supported by local police, massacred and injured hundreds of Black Greenwood residents, looted and destroyed Black businesses, and firebombed Black homes. The survivors and their descendants never received compensation for what are now millions of dollars in losses. And there are remains in mass graves that have never been recovered. A decade before Greenwood was at its height, East St. Louis was home to around 6,000 African Americans. As a result of the Great Migration, by 1917, the number of Black people in the city had doubled, with many searching for job opportunities with industries that had located in and around the city, such as meatpacking, metalworking, and the railroad. Companies actively recruited Black people from the rural South to avoid granting white workers higher wages and to break their efforts to unionize. This strategy was so effective that on May 28, 1917, white workers, including strikers from aluminum ore company, packed a local city council meeting to protest against Black workers, rather than the exploitation practiced by white company owners. After the meeting, the white attendees went downtown and began attacking Black people. That summer, white people pulled Black people off streetcars to attack them and drove through Black neighborhoods to shoot into homes. Then, on July 1st, Black residents fired back after yet another drive-by shooting and killed two white plainclothes police detectives. Over the next 2 days, white people massacred, lynched, and injured hundreds of Black East St. Louisans and set hundreds of Black homes on fire as the police and the Illinois National Guard stood by. Ida B. Wells reported on the stories of survivors, calling the massacre the greatest outrage of the century. Marcus Garvey said it was a crime against the laws of humanity. And the NAACP staged a silent protest in New York City. The survivors and descendants of the East St. Louis massacre also experienced what are now millions of dollars in losses, as well as decades of trauma, grief, and haunting memories. J.D.'s vision for a thriving, prosperous Black community in East St. Louis imagines what the city would be like if Black people were allowed to flourish without white supremacist attacks, racist hatred, or anti-Black policies. And that vision began to take shape when he and a group of coworkers decided to organize at their workplace.
Empire 13 was formed last year on actually Juneteenth of 2020. My activist group is a group started as a group of Empire Comfort System workers. We were experiencing racial discrimination on an extreme level, from being spit on, cussed out at, threatened, attacked. And we would report this to our upper management, HR executives, and write complaints. And nothing was being done about it. They'll let anything happen to us. We were being treated like second-rate citizens, hands down. And we decided to take a stand against it. And when I decided to take a stand and I formed Empire 13 and my Black coworkers rallied with me, we protested against that racial injustice on the workplace. And we started to champion the racial injustices in all aspects of the government, from police reform to racist ordinances inside our city.
But in East St. Louis, it's nearly impossible to advocate for racial justice without considering environmental issues as well. For example, Black residents of East St. Louis have long been concerned about the Veolia Environmental Services incinerator, which is located nearby in the predominantly white industrial suburb of Sauget, Illinois. In recent years, the EPA relaxed requirements for the incinerator to monitor emissions for heavy metals, such as mercury, lead, and arsenic, but required the city to install activated carbon injection systems, which would reduce mercury emissions without monitoring or reducing other metals.
When we learned about the chemicals and the that were being burned in the atmosphere right outside of East St. Louis, but was affecting the East St. Louis residents on a high degree, and environmental racism was being unchecked, and this is something that's been going on for decades, we wanted to champion that cause and bring awareness to that cause. And when we did, and we held our first couple of cleanups, it garnered the attention and the awareness that we needed to start the conversation for legislation reform.
Empire 13 hosted their first community cleanup last fall, around the time that environmental activists sued the Department of Defense to block Veolia from disposing of firefighting foam, which contains PFAS, substances that can lead to cancer, suppressed immune systems, fertility issues, and other serious health problems.
Our community cleanup is to push legislation to get the state and federal to act, and not only to act, but to create cleaning crews and jobs within the city that will continue our efforts and keep it up to keeping the city clean, the abandoned buildings taken down, and those acres and acres of land used, and that land purified and cleaned by the government to where we can start agriculture again and we can build businesses.
There are East St. Louis residents who say that on certain days, the grass is brown instead of green, and that they can't garden because the ground is so contaminated. J.D. hopes that the government makes it a priority to reduce and remediate toxins in East St. Louis.
We will no longer smell the sour, pungent smell that we smell even here in Belleville. It's like it's a smell that I can't even describe. It kind of burns my nose and everything. That smell will be gone. It'll be a whole lighter atmosphere.
Back in January, President Biden promised to direct 40% of environmental-related funds to communities with high numbers of low-income and minority residents. And J.D. remembers when President Clinton allocated millions of dollars toward Empowerment Zone jobs grants to four St. Louis area communities, including East St. Louis, in the early 90s. So he's advocating for environmental remediation jobs to be accessible for the people most impacted by environmental racism.
The Black community, we have the highest rate of incarceration due to the disparities and the misuse and just the systemic racism of the laws that has been perpetuated through our government. The laws have been stacked against us, and we all know this. So to, and I just wanted to make sure that they, that those that have been incarcerated are not excluded from another job just because they have been incarcerated.
This is one of 10 demands listed in an online petition that he's addressed to Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White. There are other demands that call for sanctions and fines to ensure that resources and public services are allocated fairly across St. Clair County, and to hold industrial companies like Big Rivers Inc., Pfizer Inc., and Monsanto accountable for toxin remediation in East St. Louis.
Our whole thing is they can't stop the revolution. The revolution doesn't stop just because we get bumped into one wall or run into one wall or whatever obstacle may come, you know, ahead of us. We keep going. We keep pushing. We don't stop. Whatever it is, we have to do to get justice. We don't stop. If there's no justice, then there's no peace. So we will continue our efforts. We will continue pushing our petition until it's heard. We are going to be going to the state capitol of Illinois. We will be going to city halls all across Illinois, protesting in front of these city halls, protesting in front of the state capitol, demanding justice for environmental racism in the Black communities in Illinois. Environmental racism is real. The government is seeing it's real, but they have to act on it. And if they choose not to act on it, then we will take it straight to their doorsteps, because that's what protesting is. It's the voice of the unheard. So if they don't want to hear us, we will make them hear us. And that's what protesting is for. That's what our community cleanup efforts is for. And that's what Empire 13 will do. It's no stopping this. We're going, we keep going until we get justice, whether it's a year, 10 years, 15 years, however long it takes, that's how long it takes.
He says that Empire 13's Boots to the Streets campaign has attracted activists and advocates across Illinois because East St. Louis is the visual representation of environmental racism.
Right now, it's everybody versus racism. That's the change that we're seeing in America. And I believe this is just a fight that people definitely want to take up, because it's something that we could physically also do together, come together, build that community and camaraderie, and infect change even without the government, because the change is in us. So we could get out there and do something ourselves to affect change. And I think that's what also draws people in.
As he builds relationships across the state, he wants people to understand who East St. Louisans really are.
We are people. We are loving, caring people. We are people that have been oppressed. We are people that have suffered environmental injustice, and you see it. And all we've been doing and all we ever wanted was fairness and a chance to live just as good as everybody else, to get the same resources and get the same resources allocated to us that all the that the towns of Belleville and Fairview Heights and O'Fallon get. And the perception that East St. Louis is just a bad town comes from the perpetuation, the systemic racism. And I just want people to know that that's not East St. Louis. East St. Louis is not what the perpetuation of racism says it is. I want to create an environment for the next generation in the Black community that inspires hope, that shows that you can be anything, and that inspires community camaraderie and take pride in your community, take pride in in your environment, because our environment was changed and cleaned and brought back to its glory because of community. Why hasn't the EPA sent in, teams and droves of scientists, environmental cleanists, everything to fix this problem? Why are they ignoring it? And they need to take action now. And I just want to know, why haven't they taken action? With everything that's going on in this country right now, why haven't they come down to East St. Louis? Why haven't they contacted the mayor of East St. Louis, the city council of East St. Louis, or Washington Park, or all of these surrounding Black communities that you see with your eyes has been affected by systemic environmental racism? Why is it that you're still not doing anything?
To get some answers, I spoke to Alan Waltz, who has worked at the Region 5 Federal Environmental Protection Agency since 1996. His office coordinates enforcement and environmental justice programs for Illinois, among several other states and 35 tribal nations. He also has experience with Superfund, a program that was started in 1980 when Congress passed the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act.
Superfund is a program that's all about dealing with legacies of contamination and restoring this land to productive reuse where it's contributing to community well-being. That community involvement piece is so important when there's concerned residents and where there's the potential to hear their input about what should the cleanup look like. And just as importantly, once we've got it cleaned up, what do we do next to make that land something that's going to provide economic benefits to the community and a source of property tax revenue, hopefully a source of jobs, right? Or maybe even a green space restoration, depending on the nature of the site. And again, what the community's priorities and aspirations really are.
He explains that there are multiple steps to getting a site to be listed under Superfund. And that's just the start of the process of reducing exposure to toxins, remediating those toxins, and eventually making the site usable.
So we have to make sure our legal case is sound, our science is sound, and we also have to allow time within that at different points. Like when we select a remedy, we need to allow time for public comment. When we publish a consent decree, we need to allow time for public comment. Each of those points of public participation, although they're spaced out along the process, as we, you know, in between, we're getting our ducks in a row and doing our homework, queuing up a decision. When we do queue up that decision for review, we do everything in our power to make sure that the public's voice is being heard. But I fully appreciate how frustrating it could be, you know, that there could be a 5-6 year time span when most of the work that's going on is those negotiations and that science work, and folks are not hearing enough.
He says that all of these steps take time. Time where it might seem that the EPA is doing nothing.
Even when we complete a stage of cleanup, every 5 years, we're going to go back and check and make sure, is that remedy still protective? And we will continue to do that. So that's really our commitment. And that's what we really want to be held accountable to. So if folks tell us, right, we haven't heard from you for a while, we're not really sure you're doing anything out there, what are you doing to move this forward? And in the meantime, what are you doing to protect my community? We welcome those conversations, and we put people on our frontline staffers who know this stuff at a really intimate scale. We make them available to have those conversations and answer those questions, because it's so important that those legitimate questions get a full and accurate answer.
I did some digging to find out what the EPA is doing now to remediate toxins in the soil and water in Superfund Areas 1 and 2 in Sauget, Illinois, the industrial suburb near East St. Louis. There are some areas where toxins are being contained and remediated, and a 5-year review of the site has been completed. But other areas will be implementing their remedies later. For example, there's one area that might use a forced air technique to break up volatile organic compounds in the soil, which will allow them to break down naturally. But the report for the pilot study of this technique will be submitted to the EPA next month. Each of these remedies costs tens of millions of dollars and take years to test and implement. Alan reminded us that for every Superfund site, there's a community involvement coordinator whose number is listed on the specific Superfund website. And for residents who don't have access to the internet, Superfund documents are available at the local public library. But he acknowledges that the EPA could do better with proactive community involvement.
So if we have not perfected our public engagement in every area, we are not done with our job. And I think there is recognition of that. We have an advisory committee called the National Environmental Justice Advisory Committee. Function of the NEJAC is to provide advice to EPA in specific ways that we could better integrate environmental justice into our work.
A recent report of the NEJAC Superfund Working Group recommended that the EPA more consistently engage with impacted communities from the beginning of a site's cleanup process, from planning to cleanup to reuse and redevelopment. They added that community concerns, even beyond the limits of Superfund, should be recognized. For sites that aren't listed under Superfund, such as areas where JD might be doing community cleanups, there's the Brownfields program.
Not every contaminated site is going to get listed on Superfund and is going to have this huge sort of influx of resources where we have a potentially responsible party who can spend the money to clean it up. There's a lot of sites that are still contaminated enough to hinder their redevelopment. And so we try to remove the barriers to reinvesting in those sites. And we try to do it in a way that fosters community well-being and fosters community aspirations. So one of the things that Brownfields includes is a job trainings grant. We specifically make sure that we're investing in where we're doing cleanup work in a community. We're doing everything that we can to create economic opportunity and create jobs for the folks who live in that community and who have potentially borne the brunt of having that contaminated site within their community.
There's a lot of overlap between the EPA's goals and JD's vision, but there remains a gap in practice as long as activists like JD feel disconnected and ignored by government agencies and elected officials.
I want to affirm that it's really important to hear those voices. You know, there's always more that we can do. It's an opportunity to hear those concerns, and I would welcome to hear more about what we can do to engage with that concerned citizen, as well as with the city of East St. Louis, to make sure they've got all the information they want about this site.
JD is one of many Black residents of the Metro East area of Illinois who are taking action to improve conditions for their communities without waiting for the government. So up next, we'll hear from a political science professor about how decisions made by industrial companies have lingering consequences today. And a reporter will share how other Black residents in the Metro East area of Illinois are pushing back against environmental racism. To understand how decisions made by industrial companies impact East St. Louisans today, I spoke to Dr. Andrew Andy Theising, professor of political science at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
For the last 25 years, I have been working in and around East St. Louis. I did my doctoral dissertation on it back in the 1990s, starting in 1993. And I have been studying and working in both East St. Louis and the surrounding communities like Sauget up to this day.
He explains that back in the 1920s, environmental laws were local laws, and there was much less environmental regulation on a national level than today.
Some cities had environmental laws, and they had quality of life laws. They liked to use the term nuisance law back in the day. And they had these quality of life laws in place. Other cities intentionally did not have them. In fact, some of them, particularly the city of Monsanto, that is now Sauget, bragged about not having these nuisance laws.
At most, there have only been a couple hundred people living in the predominantly white working class city of Monsanto, now called Sauget, Illinois.
I think these folks all worked at the factories. They all have the same employer. They have a common interest and a common bond. And I think that they are very happy to live in this corporate environment. There are no schools in Sauget. There are no churches in Sauget. There's no, you know, Knights of Columbus Hall or you know, Elk Lodge or anything. It is just industry.
The Monsanto Chemical Company founded the city of Monsanto in the Metro East area of Illinois back in 1926 to avoid environmental regulations and high taxes.
These little industrial suburbs that were created by industry for industry could be a haven for this stuff, and they could produce just as much pollution. But instead of producing it in the city, they're producing it right next to the city, which is not really any better than producing it in the city. It's still putting all these toxins out. Places like East St. Louis had lots of people living in it. There were tens of thousands of people living in East St. Louis. At the turn of the last century, there was nearly 80 to 90,000 people in the years after World War II. This city was just packed with people, and it had schools and churches and faith communities and social clubs. And so it had to protect its social interest. And so these factories didn't locate in East St. Louis. Instead, they located right outside of East St. Louis. They're right up next to the city limits, or they're just, you know, a mile down the road. So all of those people worked at these factories, but the city didn't control it. The city didn't get any taxation from it. And in some cases, these small towns, these little industrial suburbs, actually use some of the city's services, fire protection, perhaps even police protection, perhaps even sewer infrastructure. And so, you know, here they're getting kind of a free ride. And because they don't really have any residents in them, these industrial suburbs don't need hospitals, don't need churches, don't really have any of the kinds of social supports, like a school system, that any other city would have to have.
Monsanto welcomed other industrial companies to their city, such as Cerro Copper, Obernester Glass, and Big River Zinc.
Someone from Big River Zinc told me the story of how they used to do that. And zinc ore has magnesium in it, he told me. And the way to separate out is just to boil it. And the magnesium just boils off. It goes up the smokestack with the steam and other impurities, and it just goes up in the out into the atmosphere and drifts over East St. Louis. And so here's this heavy metal, another toxic metal, that is out there in East St. Louis.
Monsanto manufactured caustic acid there, and later PCBs, which are associated with cancer, immune and reproductive harm, and other serious health problems. Like many of the toxins produced in Sogé, PCBs don't break down naturally and will persist in the environment without intervention. Andy says that there were industrial suburbs across the country until World War II, when states got involved with environmental regulation.
The Campbell Soup Company dominated the government in Camden, New Jersey. Gary, Indiana is Chicago's industrial suburb. It's the workbench, and you know, it's across a state line, and it's downwind of the central city, just like here in St. Louis. And so, United States Steel just dominated, the steel mills dominated Gary, Indiana, and they dictated, you know, who would be mayor, and they dictated, you know, what would be offered as far as city services go.
Then, in the 1970s, the national government got involved with environmental regulation, just as industrial suburbs began to decline.
We saw the tremendous collapse of these industrial suburbs. The one exception to this really is Sogé. The companies that I mentioned before, Cerro Copper, Big River Zinc, Monsanto, you know, yeah, the ownership has changed, but these companies are still there. They are still producing. I had a colleague say once that they have to operate those factories, even if they're operating them at a loss, because now you got to clean it up if you closed it down.
And Black residents of East St. Louis still have to live with environmentally disastrous decisions made by their industrial neighbors today.
So if you say, it's a free market, why don't they just leave? Well, they can't, because they can't find a comparably priced home in an area that doesn't have these environmental hazards. And it's a pretty sad statement to say, in order for me to get housing that I can afford, I have to expose myself to chemicals, to carcinogens. I have to give up my life. I have to give up my old age. I have to give up my grandkids so that I can live in a place that's affordable. What a terrible position. And we have whole neighborhoods of people who are experiencing that. And yes, everything that happened in Sogé was legal. these companies were licensed, they were embraced, they paid their taxes. There weren't a lot of taxes, but they paid them. And it was perfectly legal. But thinker Robert Dahl says, what is legal is not always just. Slavery was legal. Segregation was legal. Jim Crow was legal. Separate drinking fountains. That was all legal. And it was all a tremendous injustice.
Like JD, Andy believes that there are actions that can be taken now to address environmental racism.
I think there's a threefold attack. The first is we have to quit making new pollution. We have to regulate very tightly. We have to regulate what is allowed into the atmosphere. And by and large, the EPA does this now. All of those companies that are still operating there, they're operating in a much different way than they did in the 1920s and 30s. The second part is we have to fix the damage that's already been done, doing the cleanup, remediating the soil. If the water is carrying pollutants downstream, let's fix the water so that it's not carrying these existing pollutants down into neighborhoods anymore.
Since the early 90s, both Sauget and East St. Louis have had ordinances prohibiting the use of groundwater as drinking water due to contamination. Instead, they use the Mississippi River as a source for drinking water. The federal EPA says that soil, sediment, surface water, and source area remedies must be applied before groundwater remediation can even begin.
And then to me, the third piece of it is we need to protect the people who must live there, either by expanding their choices or giving them something so they can stay in place safely.
He suggests that companies have a responsibility as well.
Not only are we going to assess our company on its financial performance, that's the first bottom line, but what's our environmental performance? What's our environmental impact? Are we working at the expense of the environment? What's our relationship with the community that houses our facilities? Are we operating at their expense?
Moving forward, Andy hopes that people, including corporate and government leaders, will examine the communal consequences of our actions and make decisions that will positively impact generations to come.
Everything around us is a decision. And decisions have consequences. And so many of the things that we have been talking about, that we see in places like East St. Louis, are consequences of decisions made 50, 100 or more years ago. And so I hope that people will think that the decisions we make today can have a consequence that will go 50 or 100 years in the future. Just like we're dealing with the consequences of the past, someone else will get the consequences of our choices. I'll be dead and gone by the time some of these folks are going to be experiencing these consequences. And I hope that they are getting a good consequence from our choices. We've seen bad consequences follow us for 50 or 100 years. Let's turn that around and let's give a good consequence.
Andy emphasizes that East St. Louisans are leading the way in proposing good solutions for the environment.
The people of East St. Louis are not, you know, they're not these passive citizens who only let stuff happen to them. The people of East St. Louis have been vocal and they have shown up and they have organized and they have engaged these companies.
And DeAsia Page, a reporter who covers East St. Louis and its surrounding areas for the Belleville News Democrat, agrees.
They're not just these helpless, you know, victims. They're actively engaged in what they want to see in their city, and they're not going to, you know, they're dedicated. They're not going to stop. And that to me is very inspiring, especially when, you know, you're at a disadvantage, you know, already. And so I think, you know, that speaks to the culture of East St. Louis. They are this quote unquote, the city of champions. That's, you know, their nickname. I think that's true, especially in, you know, the city and just speaking with residents about that.
DeAsia is from Chicago, so when she started at the Belleville News Democrat in June, she had to deal with mistrust caused by decades of media misrepresentations and stereotypes of East St. Louisans.
And so it took a while for them to kind of warm up to me. I'm still like trying to navigate that issue, but I do try to make myself as accessible as possible to residents to let them know that they can trust me with what they say and that I won't, you know, misconstrue like anything that they're telling me, and that they know that they can trust me, that they can talk to me about really anything. And that, you know, when I first started, I would just, it would just be simple as like attending these regular virtual meetings or city council meetings or community events or just driving by the city just so that people can know my face and know who I am. And, or even just something to just having, you know, I call them beat building calls with residents in the community just to get to know, you know, get to know them and then also get to know like, you know, their background.
By making it clear that she's accountable to residents and is committed to sharing their stories, DeAsia was able to build relationships with longtime East St. Louisans like Mamie Cozy.
She mentions how she always can, you know, smell the incinerator, how it's very toxic. And, you know, she takes care of her grandchildren. I think she just turned 80 this past January, if I'm not mistaken. So she is elderly and obviously retired, but she's taking care of her kids. Those type of situations in terms of the Veolia incinerator does create, you know, just a sort of toxic environment for residents to live in. It's like, these are also poor residents. So it's not as easy as, oh, well, I'll move somewhere else. Well, no, I can't, you know, I can't afford to move, or I don't have the means to move somewhere else and take my children or grandchildren somewhere else.
DeAsia connects the dots between health issues faced by East St. Louisans and the experience of Black residents across the Metro East area of Illinois.
Asthma is a very common issue for residents in East St. Louis, and not just East St. Louis, but also Centerville and Cahokia, which is also like about 10 minutes away from East St. Louis, also Black majority populations as well. So I hear from a lot of residents that they do struggle with respiratory issues. And that's really the main thing that I've heard from residents. And then most of them are elderly, but even the Eastside Health District, one interview, the director was telling me that, you know, it's very common for residents to, you know, have environmentally induced asthma because they didn't have it before, you know, moving into these areas. So, you know, when I say environmental racism is probably the starting point of some of the issues, because it leads to other issues like public health issues. And if you have respiratory issues, that makes you more susceptible to other, you know, diseases and viruses like, you know, COVID-19. I know me and another reporter did this story maybe last July about how Black communities in the Metro East are like 3 times more likely to contract COVID, even though they don't represent that in the population of the Metro East.
Pollution created by industrial companies is just one source of environmental racism. For residents of Centerville, Illinois, now Cahokia Heights, neglect and mismanagement of public infrastructure on a local level is another.
Residents there have been dealing with flooding issues for maybe decades, 30 to 20 years. It's a really sad situation because most of the residents there, they are Black, they are also poor, but they also are elderly. So that leaves them with like as minimal resources as possible. Local government in those areas have not been heavily involved in fixing the issue as much as they should be. So that kind of leaves residents with, you know, just kind of like fending for themselves and finding ways to, you know, just deal with the flooding issues on their own. I know I've talked to one resident, how she mentions that, you know, sewage gets in her basement, and she often has to not only clean it up, but also try to get some bleach or something to kind of, you know, lessen how bad of a smell it is in her home. She also has asthma as well, and she believes that it's because of the flooding issues in her home that she's constantly had to deal with.
Back in June, when DeAsia first started reporting on the Metro East, two Centerville residents, Cornelius Bennett and Early Fuse, filed a lawsuit with the help of Equity Legal Services and the Metropolitan St. Louis Equal Housing and Opportunity Council against the city of Centerville and the common fields of Cahokia Public Water District, which operates Centerville's sewage system. The introduction to the lawsuit notes that East St. Louis and Centerville are so close that they share a zip code, and asserts that conditions of poverty, segregation, and raw sewage are due to a string of collective decisions not to invest in the community. At stake in this lawsuit are living conditions and the opportunity for Black communities to build generational wealth through home ownership. It alleges that the city of Centerville, the Common Fields, and the officials who represent them are responsible for failing to repair or replace broken wastewater lift stations and barely functioning infrastructure. The lawsuit states that as a result, for over a decade, Mr. Bennett has dealt with raw sewage and flooding in his home. He hauls wheelbarrows of lime to manage the smell in his yard, where it's unsafe for his grandchildren to play. And when it floods, he can't flush his toilets or access certain parts of his property for hours or even days. Mr. Fuse, who has dealt with these issues for over two decades, also gets trapped in his home when it floods, and his basement has collapsed four times in the rain.
I know Governor Pritzker recently acknowledged, you know, the issue in Centerville for like the first time, maybe a month or some weeks ago. There are some grants that they've applied for that they're waiting to hear back from. I know one of them is from FEMA. There does seem to be some movement, but all this, you know, constant, I guess this sort of progress now, if you want to call it that, sort of like begs the question of why couldn't they get this, you know, years ago when this started? Because now it's like, you know, I mean, they obviously want help, but are they going to trust the help given that they haven't gotten it in so long?
She says Centerville residents are concerned about environmental funds being allocated in an effective and transparent manner.
There's these like new grants that the city is applying for. And they are concerned about, you know, if, you know, once they do get this money, will it go to the same, you know, elected officials who have been neglecting them for years? And that's, you know, pretty understandable given that they haven't received help for years, like until now, which is really sad. So, you know, I think it just goes with that like lack of transparency that has been shown with some local officials in Centerville and East St. Louis and other communities.
That's why she says that community engagement is crucial for progress.
These federal and local organizations just have to ensure that their plans, you know, while, you know, they may be well-intentioned, if they don't include the community, like, holistically, then, you know, there's an issue with that, or it's not going to be well received, obviously, because it's like, you know, you're not including the voice of the people that you don't really know. To kind of sort of bridge that gap, I think the community needs to be involved with whatever is going on, like from day one.
Until that happens, DeAsia will continue to build relationships and share stories as a community reporter.
I would just want to create the type of environment where everyone in the community feels comfortable talking to me and telling me their stories, and that nobody's story will get neglected if you do talk to me. I just want to create that type of environment where people who have been neglected for years and media coverage, you know, get their chance to tell their stories as well, because everybody's, you know, stories matter as long as they're not causing any harm to anybody. But I do think that it's important that everybody, you know, deserves to be heard and listened to. I do want to create the type of environment where everybody feels comfortable, you know, talking to me, especially Black communities and other communities of color that have been neglected in, you know, media coverage.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. Thanks to Eric Schmid, St. Louis Public Radio reporter for the Metro East area of Illinois, and Eli Chen, former St. Louis Public Radio science reporter, for providing background information and reporting to shape this episode. To learn more about the Centerville sewage crisis, visit floodedandforgotten.com. You can stay updated about what J.D. Dixon and his coalition is doing in East St. Louis by following the Empire 13 Facebook page. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.